you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
Welcome to Visionaries. I'm John Lobel, your host. You'll find us here on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, Mondays at 10 a.m. on Visionaries. We talk about creativity in the arts, science, technology, culture, and spirituality, and about how we can enrich the world and ourselves by tapping into the energies of the cosmos. I'm going to talk today about two worlds that I live in. One of them is academic, where you can't say cosmos because you can't measure it, right? How can a sociologist or a psychologist measure the increase or decrease of the energy of a cosmos in their rats after they've run them through a maze? But anyway, that's getting ahead of myself. Along the way on Visionaries, we talk with some of the most interesting people in the world about worlds we live in and the worlds they're creating for tomorrow, although today, no guest, I have something special in mind. But first, let's get up to date and remind everybody about our past shows. If you were listening earlier, we had one of our back shows where I was interviewing Bob Walter, the president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. So if you go to the PRN archives or go to visionaries.podbean.com, visionaries.podbean.com. You can find our back shows. The one we just heard is from September 26. And there I talked about Joseph Campbell with Bob Walter, who was Joseph Campbell's last editor and is president of the Joseph Campbell Foundation that manages Campbell's literary estate. So there you'll find terrific resources, bibliographies of all the books. You can buy tapes of Campbell lecturing, which I cannot recommend too much. Just incredible experience listening to him lecture. Back on October 3rd, And again, you can find this on the archive. I interviewed Natasha Vita Moore, who is famous as a transhumanist. And so you'll find out on that show what transhumanism is. A lot of stuff going on out there. Since you're maybe listening online, you can have Google open right while we're talking and put in 2045. That's an organization. It's a group of Russian oligarchs that are building avatars into which to download themselves so that they can not die. So pretty wild stuff going on out there. Natasha is the president of Humanity Plus. You can also look them up. And lots of really interesting stuff. We talked about her books, etc. Strongly recommend that show. And then on September 19th, I had on Luis Arana, senior artificial intelligence engineer for Robots Without Borders. So we all know Doctors Without Borders. And these people are thinking about artificial intelligence, about this coming world where home healthcare workers, cleaning up. We're talking about momentarily truck drivers disappearing, long-haul trucking being done by self-driving vehicles. We all know that Uber and Google and Tesla are all working on self-driving cars. And then we think, when are they going to be here? And the answer is, if you have a Tesla, you just push a button and it goes on autopilot. Some people have gotten into trouble doing that, but the thing is, even at their worst, and of course they'll keep getting better, self-driving cars are going to be 100 times safer than human-driven cars, which kill, 30,000 people a year or something like that. So those are some of our back shows. There's another one from September 12 where I talked about my book, Visionary Creativity. I'll mention that again in a minute. So that's our back shows. This show today will be on the archive shortly. So go to prn.fm, click on Archives, search for Visionaries, or go to Visionaries in the Schedule, click on it, and you're right there at visionaries.podbean, podbean.com, and you can hear all of our back shows. So today, again, a little bit different, I want to talk about technology. Before I do that, a little bit about me. I'm a professor of architecture at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. And Brooklyn was once, a little bit off to the side. It's suddenly the hottest spot on the planet. At Pratt's an art, architecture, and design school, we get students from all over the world. Of course, all schools do these days. And we have a building in Manhattan, as well as our Brooklyn campus, and some of the programs are in Manhattan. We have students who come from other countries, and they're in the program. They didn't realize that it was in Manhattan, and they said, we thought we were going to be in Brooklyn. Manhattan's not good enough. So I teach in Brooklyn, so I can now be really proud to say that. I'm the author of several books, and one I'll mention now and is pertinent to this show is called Visionary Creativity, How New Worlds Are Born. And it says right on the cover, visionary creatives swim in the culture of our day. The things they create in art, design, science, technology, business, embody our culture and at the same time pull us into the future. So I'll do more about my book on another show. But for now, just to say that we all have something in mind when we say creativity. And, of course, it's a fuzzy term and it means lots of different things. But I mean something very specific by the term visionary creativity. And what I mean is our world is not given. We make it. We make our world, the Renaissance world of humanism that identified the individual. We make our world of the vision of human equality and an understanding of the world through rationality and science of the Enlightenment. We made the modern world, and we are right now today making our postmodern world, and it's visionary creatives who take the lead in making those worlds so that when we have a painting like Picasso's Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, it's shattering a previous vision of who and what we were as human beings and creating a new one. So that's what my book is about. But it looks not only at painting, but at science, technology, etc. And you can get it on Amazon, barnesandnoble.com, and I blog about it at visionarycreativity.com. So you can check my blog there. And if you want to know more about me, you can find me at johnlobel.com. So it's got my back books and PDFs of my books and articles and lots of information about me, my resume, etc. And guess what? In our modern world, we're talking about technology today, you can friend me on Facebook and you can follow me on Twitter. I actually hire students to tutor me on how to use that stuff. What's a hashtag? What am I supposed to do? What's the difference between a group and a page on Facebook? So I get help with all that, but you can keep up with me in some ways there. So again, about today, I usually have a guest on this show, but today I want to do something else and spend the hour talking about technology. So let's start with the question, what is the world going to be like in 100 years? So, like most people, I would assume what you might do, what I did, and say, okay, let's just do some very round numbers and say it's the year 2000. Let's go back to the year 1900. What happened between 1900 and 2000? And of course, we got the automobile. It was a little bit earlier, the airplane, 1903. And then all of these developments. So that was 100 years. So now let's extrapolate forward another 100 years. So according to Ray Kurzweil, wrong. That's totally not what's going to happen. And Ray Kurzweil says, we won't experience 100 years of progress in the 21st century, the next 100 years. It'll be more like 20,000 years of progress at today's rate. So Kurzweil says this in his book, The Singularity is Near, and in all of his talks. So just a bit, Ray Kurzweil is probably the most prominent futurist at the moment. And he's an advocate of something called the singularity, which has been around a while. He didn't invent the term, but it's a notion that we are approaching a moment of technological development where we'll freak out. There's several definitions of the singularity. One is technological change starts to happen so rapidly that we can't even comprehend it. And another definition is it's when artificial intelligence exceeds human intelligence. So either way, it's fast on its way. And now let's think about what that means. And I said earlier, I live in two worlds. And a reminder of that to me every morning is there's several newsletters that I get delivered to my email box, and even if you don't get them delivered, you can just go check the news items every morning. So, as I said, I'm a professor at Pratt Institute, so I get a newsletter called Inside Higher Education, insidehighered.com. Okay, and it is news about academia, what's going on, people's thoughts, problems at schools, what's going on with the liberal arts, stuff like that. And a lot of people freaking out about MOOCs. So what is a MOOC? A MOOC is a massive open online course. In other words, just the way Uber is shattering the yellow cab taxi industry, what happens when students don't have to take the rinky-dink professor at their rinky-dink college for Sociology 101, they can click and take some famous big-name sociological professor at some big-name college online. And then at their school, they can have discussion groups and sections and stuff like that. So what is that going to do? Big discussion. And mostly the people who are frequent this newsletter are against it. Whatever it is, they're against it. Another newsletter I get is KurzweilAI.net. So again, we're all following online during listening to the show. So just go up to your address bar and put in KurzweilAI.net. So that's Kurzweil for Ray Kurzweil, AI for artificial intelligence. And you can read his newsletter there, and his other material, of course, on his website. Or you can subscribe, and then it'll show up every morning in your mailbox. It is usually about 3 to 6 stories. And the stories will just have one sentence summary. And then you can click on it if you want to follow through. I'll mention some of them as we go along. But it's developments in health, technology, artificial intelligence, things like that. And totally technologically optimistic. As I quoted earlier, Kurzweil says in the next 100 years, we're going to experience 20,000 years of technological development. So what's that going to mean? So I want to begin with the world, one of the worlds I live in, the academic world, where we encounter a lot of technological pessimism. So technological pessimism holds that technology is bringing us a lot of bad stuff to our environment, global warming, environmental degradation, depletion of resources, to our society, income inequality, loss of jobs, loss of control by government, to our culture, mindless popular entertainment, in sum, a bleak future of impoverished subjugation. Now, I'm going to argue that some of these are real problems, some are not, but those that are real problems come not from technology, but from our politics, from the way we are constructing our society. So let's look a little bit more at that argument and look at some of this pessimism. So, test question when I teach, you know, I can call on people to raise their hands. What's the key most famous work in technological pessimism? The world is only headed for disaster. Anybody? It's, of course, Thomas Malthus, Malthusianism. And Thomas Malthus in 1798, key date, think of all that's going on around then. The whole modern world is being born. Well, Malthus observes that populations grow exponentially. They double every certain period of time. And food production grows linearly, and pretty soon everybody's going to starve. And the only thing wrong is it didn't happen. But the idea is still with us. So we have books like The Population Bomb by Pearl Ehrlich. The opening line of The Population Bomb is, in the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death. And it goes on from there to get worse for a whole book. And this book was huge. Back in those days, the Johnny Carson-type shows had on not just movie actors promoting their current movie, but actually had leading intellectuals on, opera singers, people writing socially important things. And Ehrlich was often on those shows, spreading this doom and gloom that these terrible things are going to happen. Ehrlich writes, hundreds of millions of people going to starve to death in spite of any crash program embarked upon now. So no matter what we do, it's going to happen. And we can only hope to, you know, somewhat mitigate. And when 90% of people have died off, then we can get back to something a little more sustainable. Another book, just that was 1968. 1972, just a couple of years later, a book came out called Limits to Growth, sponsored by something called the Club of Rome. And I know that book pretty well because I used it in my teaching. And there was another book shortly thereafter called The Next 200 Years, which refuted it. So I would have my students read both. And what Limits to Growth did was, well, they used computers, so must have been right. So what they did is they looked at world population, industrialization, pollution, food production, and resource depletion. So these five variables. And they plotted them all against each other. So, for example, if you increase industrialization, you'll increase pollution. If you increase food production, you'll increase world population. So it plots all these things, and it's filled with charts and graphs of these plots. And all of them show somewhere around, I think, next Thursday, the entire world collapsing because population's growing, there's not enough food. You grow more food, the population will grow faster, it'll collapse even worse. So no matter what you do, it's all going to collapse. And all the graphs show this collapse. There's only one model which does not collapse. And in that model, we go to stasis. Stop population growth, stop industrialization, stop using stop the increase in use of natural resources, et cetera, and we can level things out, and we'll have a kind of a dull and but safe life without collapse. And sort of like Europe, just to pick on just to pick on somebody. So go to Wikipedia, look up limits to growth, and you'll find an excellent discussion of it. And of course, on Amazon, you can get old used copies, you know, usually for a penny plus shipping. So highly recommended. I'm still addicted to books. I can't believe it. I pay, I'll say it, I'll confess, $500 a month for a mini storage full of my books. And that's after taking thousands of them, literally, to Strand Books. They don't pay what they used to. But anyway, in response to these books, very famously, in 1980, someone named Julian Simon challenged Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb, to a bet. And the bet was, according to Ehrlich, if we're running out of everything, of course, the cost of resources is going to go sky high. Aluminum, wheat, etc., is going to become prohibitively expensive. So Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich entered into a bet. 10 years later, will a basket of commodities, and Ehrlich picked them, copper, nickel, tin, tungsten, chromium, be more expensive or less expensive? And it ended up being less expensive. Julian Simon won the bet. And these kinds of books are still coming out today. Thomas Friedman, author of the incredible book, you absolutely have to read it, The World is Flat. He's updated it a couple of times. Of course, it's some years ago, but it very much explains our world today. He wrote a book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. And around the same time, another book came out, 10 Billion, the emerging population of the world. So people are still writing books about this coming catastrophe. And we think, for example, of peak oil. And four years ago, we were told, peak oil, we're going to run out of oil. And now it's unlimited. We're not running out of oil. We're not running out of natural gas. So what actually happened? And what happened is that Ehrlich was right. The world population did double, but the rest of it wasn't right. Death rates were down, fell in half, lifespan up 30%, infant mortality down 2/3, income up 300%, calorie intake up 24%, half as much land needed to grow the same amount of food, and many pollutants in the U.S. are down 80%. Yet Ehrlich states today, the most serious flaw of the population bomb was that it was too optimistic. So what has been actually happening and what's the long history? And I strongly recommend a book called The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley. And he talks about the long term going, what, million years, but even more recently, what has led to the radical increase of affluence that we experience today. And he references three things: specialization, trade, and this great thing, put it in quotes, sex between ideas. And just one of many examples from his book. In ancient Babylonia, you had to work 300 hours for 1 hour of light, or you had your slaves work. In 1950, we had to work 8 seconds for 1 hour of light. Today, we have to work a quarter of a second for 1 hour of light. So how would you actually measure affluence? And this is an example of amount of work to get something that you need. And we see that tremendous improvement. And there are charts you can see online on YouTube showing affluence throughout the world, and it's spread to all throughout the world. Now, when I'm arguing with my colleagues at school, they often say, yeah, that's true over the past 1,000 years, but there's an argument called the Great Stagnation, and that is that since the mid-1970s, affluence in the U.S. has declined or stopped growing. Technological innovation has slowed, and maybe because we've harvested the low-hanging fruit. In other words, yeah, we have flush toilets, air conditioning, and central heat, but now what? How much better is a smartphone going to make your life? So that's the Great Stagnation argument. But even that's not really true. Since the mid-70s, life expectancy has increased 5 years. Size of the average home has doubled. The percent of people going to college and grad school has doubled. The real cost of TVs and video recorders have fallen 80%. Real cost of airfares have fallen 80%. Information has become essentially free and universally available. And even in the past 10 years in the United States, CO2 output has decreased by 13%. I'd like to see it decrease a lot more. But a lot of the replacing of coal burning by gas burning, which gas has about a third as much carbon per unit of energy as coal does, has led to a tremendous improvement. And globally, 1 billion people have left abject poverty for modest affluence. So let's go on and talk about what's actually happening. But before that, suppose we just take a break and let's take a break and we'll come back in a few minutes.
PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border, down Mexico.
I'm Johnny Mueller, host of The Expat Files, living in Latin America. Heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's a show where you'll learn how to work, play, do business, or retire and live the life of Riley. Yes, an amazing number of first world people like you are jumping off the stateside treadmill and voting with their feet. And surprise, surprise, they're finding there really is an American dream. But it's not in Seattle, Milwaukee, or Cleveland anymore. It's down here in Latin America. So be sure to tune in to The Expat Files to find out how you can live the good life on a measly Social Security check.
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myth, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM. I love science the way it should be practiced, but a lot of modern science is corrupted by financial interests and serves a master other than the public good. Myths continue to be constructed around viruses, vaccines, forensics, and pharmaceutical drugs. People are dying and ending up in jail because of them. Listen to me as I deconstruct the myths that those who call themselves scientists weave, or when I wander into social and political topics. If you're new to the show, check out our past episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com.
Welcome back. So this is Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle, your host. You find us here every Monday on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, Mondays at 10 a.m. And I've been talking today, usually we have a guest, but today I wanted to talk about something that I've been involved with, and that is the notion of technological optimism. And as I mentioned earlier, I live in two worlds. the sort of technologically pessimistic world of intellectual academia, and also the world of technological breakthroughs. And I work on some projects I'll tell you about in the future, which puts me in touch with some of the leading futurists and technology advocates of our time. But I want to talk about this different point of view, technological optimism, and look at the notion of abundance. And so things have been happening. There's a book called Abundance by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler, and they look at five things. We'll just sort of zero in on one of them. Technologies are improving at exponential rates. Prizes like the X Prize incentivize developments. Techno-philanthropists such as Bill Gates are attacking problems. Lives of the poorest have improved substantially. And independent innovators are achieving startling advances. So we have this emergence of some very wealthy people. Let's not talk about the bankers. I don't know what they do for us. But, you know, the Bill Gates of the world, the Steve Jobs of the world, what are they doing? And what does that bring us? And I'll just start with Peter Diamandis himself. So here's this guy. He's smart. He gets through college just to do it. He goes to med school. He never wanted to be a doctor. He reads The Spirit of St. Louis by Lindbergh and finds out that Lindbergh did the solo flight across the Atlantic to win a $25,000 prize. And so that modest, okay, you know, it was substantial in its day, but no big deal, that modest prize provided incentive for all these people to work to do this thing. So he created the X Prize, and it led to the beginning of commercial spaceflight. And now he has X Prizes for oil cleanup, fuel efficiency, tricorders. So remember in Star Trek where Bones just holds this gizmo over somebody, it does all the diagnosis and maybe even some of the treatment? They're coming. He's the co-founder of Singularity University. Again, look that up. And the co-founder of Planetary Resources. Now, here's how these people think. There are asteroids out there. They found one with $1 trillion worth of platinum. They're going to go get it. So that's how these, you know, private company. That's how these people are thinking. So who is, test question, who is the poster boy for our innovators today? And, of course, we all had a difficult relationship with Steve Jobs, but mostly admired him. But the new poster boy is Elon Musk, who brings us Tesla. He says, no, we can't keep using gasoline forever for our cars. And then he says, you know, we can't get along being a one-planet species, and NASA's dropped the ball. He starts SpaceX. He starts Solar City. And then he says, all these high-speed trains, the concept's all wrong. So he starts Hyperloop. So he just churns out these companies, these approaches, this one individual. Of course, not working totally alone, but providing the energy and thought. Another one, Craig Venter. Craig Venter beat the government in the race to sequence a human genome at 1/10 the cost and 1/10 the time. So now he has a company, Jake Craig Venter Institute. He notices that corn yields 16 gallons of ethanol per acre. In one of the great evils of all time, that we actually take food, people's food, and burn it in our cars. But anyway, 16 gallons per acre, he's DNA engineering algae to yield 10,000 gallons an acre. A fraction of that could fuel all the U.S. autos. Another one of these innovators, Dean Kamen. Dean Kamen brought us the not-so-successful segue, but major inventor, highly respected, things like the portable kidney dilation machine so that kidney patients can do mountain climbing and stuff. He observes that every day, 4,000 children die from dirty water. Half of all disease in the world comes from dirty water. He developed Slingshot. It's a little thing the size of a dorm refrigerator that can produce 1,000 liters a day of medically pure water at 2 cents per liter. You just plug it into raw sewage and medically pure injectable water comes out the other end. And Coca-Cola is building them and distributing test samples. So just another one of these people, Sebastian Thrun. So how many people have heard of Sebastian Thrun? Okay. How many people have heard of self-driving cars? So the DARPA, the Defense Research Operation, was working on self-driving cars. They spent $500 million over 15 years. They didn't get anywhere. So Sebastian Thrun takes 15 Stanford grad students, a $500,000 budget, and produces the Google self-driving car. And now they're all over the place. So that's just the beginning. He's the he teaches artificial intelligence at Stanford. And what can you get? You know, in the big auditorium, 150 students in his class. So he says, what if I put the course online? He gets 160,000 students taking this course, an artificial intelligence, a Stanford course. So, and then he also developed Google Glass, which is no longer with us, but some version eventually will be. We're not too sure how we feel about that. But you have these glasses, and it's recording everything around you. But imagine it's also projecting a map of where you want to go. You know, everything your cell phone does, why do I have this thing in my pocket? I mean, it's in my pocket. What good does it do me in my pocket? So there it is in the lens of your glasses projected out in front of you. You're thinking and it's doing, you know, Google search or maps or whatever. So one person just churning this stuff out. And so now I'm going to argue about a notion called abundance and think in terms of moving from scarcity to abundance. So what is scarcity? Scarcity is the Colorado River. If you take water out of the Colorado River, there's less for me. There's only a finite amount. So in scarcity, the more you use, the less there is, the more degraded it is, the more expensive it is. In abundance, the more you use, the more there is, the better it is, the cheaper it is. How could that be? Think of Wikipedia. The more people that use Wikipedia, the more people that make input. And if, you know, one day 1,000 people are accessing an article I'm looking at, and the next day 100,000 people are accessing that article, it's not harder for me. It doesn't say, well, you can't get it today because 100,000 people are accessing it. So that's abundance, where the more you use, the more there is, the better it is, the cheaper it is. So the first thing that brings that about is exponential growth. And that's what Ray Kurzweil is talking about in The Singularity Is Near. And they're fun games with exponential growth. So what's exponential growth? And that's Moore's Law. The capability of the computer chip doubles every 18 months. Okay. But then Ray Kurzweil points out, that started with the electrical relay in 1900. It's been going on for 115 years, not just since the computer chip. And Gordon Moore proposed this idea in the 60s, and it hasn't stopped. Said, well, you know, I've got this, I've got my cell phone, it's more powerful than a Cray 1 supercomputer. Yeah, today. What's it going to be like in 10 years? You know, take your cell phone from 10 years ago. You didn't realize you're going to be looking at movies on there, that it would have maps and give you turn-by-turn driving directions and everything else. You're watching YouTube videos and God knows what else it does. What's it going to do in 10 years? We can't even imagine. So two famous examples of exponential growth, long story, which I'll shorten, artisan makes chessboard of beautiful stones, gives it to a Raja, and the Raja says, this is beautiful, I'll give you anything you want. And he's smart enough, the artisan's smart enough not to ask for the Raja's daughter in marriage. He says, just give me one grain of rice on the first square of the chessboard, two on the second, four on the third, eight on the etc. And the Raja's thinking, what are we talking about, a bag of rice here? Turns out it's 1,000 times the annual global production of rice. This exponential growth gets scary. Example Peter Diamantis likes to give. Suppose you take 30 linear steps. I take a step, it's a meter, another step, 2 meters, 30 steps. I've gone 30 meters. Suppose I take 30 exponential steps. 1 meter, 2 meters, 4 meters, 8 meters. In 30 steps, I've circled the Earth 26 times. You know, you can't imagine that. I mean, what? So what does that have to do with anything? Well, who thought we were going to have crazy supercomputers in our pockets? So, and then Ray Kurzweil shows how it applies to any information technology, and medicine has become an information technology since the sequencing of human DNA. So in 1984, they sequenced human genome, $3 billion. In 1998, Craig Venter did it for $300 million. In 2007, they did James Watson's, just, you know, as a tribute. It cost $1 million. In 2011, Illumina was doing it for $5,000. Today, it's about $1,000. 23andMe will do it for you for $99. When are you going to go to CVS and get a home kit for $10 to sequence your DNA? And Craig Venter predicted it would follow an exponential downward cost, a downward trend in cost. It got cheaper a lot faster. So exponential growth. You won't experience 100 years of progress in the 21st century. It'll be more like 1,000. So what are some examples? Okay, so we have information abundance. Some examples. Wikipedia compared to Encyclopedia Britannica. Think of that expensive paper thing that some of us had, others of us had to go to the library. 1,000 times the capacity, free to everybody online. Books. I mentioned earlier how much I'd pay for a mini storage for my books. And then I have, you know, how do you find them out there? I now walk around with 100 books on my phone that I can either read or listen to, and we've got to work out property rights, but books, movies, music are becoming very economical. Search. I don't know how many people remember the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, and it's a set of volumes in the library. So I'm interested in, quantum theory and culture. And so I go to the Reader's Guide, and I find there's an article in the 1974 January issue of Atlantic Monthly. Now I go down to the basement in the library, and I hope we have a bound copy. And of course, today you just go to Google and you get a PDF. And then education. Only 18,000 students can go to Stanford. That's all that will fit. But we now have iVersity, edX, Coursera, Udacity, these MOOCs that are making lots of aspects of education available free to everyone. Of course, one-on-one on the campus is wonderful. We don't want to give that up. But, you know, there's other things happening as well. When I was a kid, I had this long playing record. One side was the size of the universe. The other side was the theory of relativity. I played it over and over. It's all I had. Every single person I've mentioned today on the radio, right here, you can go to YouTube and see a dozen lectures by them right now. And so we like to say, today a child in Africa with a smartphone has access to more information than did the president of the United States 20 years ago. And 2/3 of all Africans have phones. But how do they get connectivity? And Google and Facebook are in this race to provide free connectivity throughout the world with dirigible satellites, drones, all kinds of ways they're exploring to provide this. So, and then how powerful is your phone? And the answer is infinitely. Cloud computing, infinite computing. You don't have Wikipedia. We don't have Wikipedia on our phones. We tap into it where there can be numerous servers. And this is just the beginning. Think of sensors. So we all have a fire sensor in our apartments and smoke detectors. And there's a sensor in there. But what happens when there's a sensor on our disc brakes in our car? A sensor in a fountain pen. When it starts to run low, reorders more fountain pens from Staples. A sensor in the jug of milk in your refrigerator again, will reorder milk when it gets low. We can't even imagine how these are going to be used. In architecture, we think of sprinkling them into the walls of a building that'll detect moisture, mold, structural problems. And then the human-computer interface. We're still in the world of that original Macintosh from 1984, but now with the new iPhone, no wires. You just put these things in your ears. Think back on the Google Glass. You now have your ears and your eyes plugged in. Whole new kinds of human-computer interfaces are coming about. Quantum computing's coming about that will be millions of times more powerful than conventional computing. And I love to quote David Deutsch, a quantum computer gains its extraordinary power by harnessing its siblings in parallel universes. They're doing it now. What does that mean? So imagine you're back in the 1930s and you have telephone, AM radio, newspaper delivery. So you're getting about 60,000 bits per second of information coming into your home. Imagine that's like a faucet dripping, drip, drip. Today, imagine what it means that we have laser fiber optics with 20 billion bits per second coming into our homes. The Grand Coulee Dam has burst and it's coming in through our window. Now, what are we going to do with it? Well, it starts getting interesting. It's not just I Love Lucy reruns. There's all kinds of stuff happening. Fantastic stuff in entertainment, the great long-form series cable TV shows, but then also encyclopedias of information, etc. And it's all network-sorted, hooked together, and that will only get better. So that's information abundance. We pretty much have it. What about material abundance? How are we going to make things more affordable? And we're on the verge of what's now being called the digital industrial revolution. So imagine, you might have seen TV commercials by General Electric calling, are we a digital company or are we an industrial company? And GE now, everything they make, every jet engine, every gas turbine, every locomotive, has a twin in the cloud, a virtual twin in the cloud. And all these twins are talking to each other. And already they're talking about this has led to a 20% increase in efficiency. But that's just the beginning. What else is going to happen? 3D printing. So you might have seen those toy 3D printers. They deposit plastic. You can make little toys. They're around $500 or $1,000. But they're now being used industrially. They've 3D printed rocket engines. They could be pretty durable. New materials. Composites. The Boeing 787 is made out of plastic and they glue the wings on with epoxy. Totally new ways of making things. What's this going to mean? And now we can manipulate single atoms so that we can start with graphenes and then computer chips where the on-off is the orientation of a single atom, leading to computer chips billions of times more dense and more powerful than the ones we have today. We're talking about nanotechnology, making things out of single atoms. So I like to talk about the following idea. Imagine you want to make an oak tree. You would not put a pole in the ground, nail sticks to it, and glue leaves onto the pole. What would you do? Put an acorn in the ground. Put the information code to make an oak tree in the ground and let it make itself. Wow. Pretty soon we'll be making our cell phones that way. Now, how difficult is that? If you can make an oak tree, if you can make a human being out of a set of rules and let it make itself, it won't be long before we can make our cell phones that way. So, new ways of thinking. Let's see if, you know, where this might be going. And this, what I call genomic thinking, this idea of letting the oak tree make itself. One of the people talking about this that I'm a big fan of is Stephen Wolfram. And if you've done any work in science, you might have Mathematica on your computer. And Mathematica is Wolfram's sort of a super graphing calculator. And he's built a company around this, and now he's expanded it into some other fields. He has Wolfram Alpha, which is a search engine that's computational. So if you ask Google, what's the population of France, it'll try to find a document that has that. But if you ask, you can ask Wolfram Alpha, what's the population of France as a fraction of the population of the United States? So to go out, it'll get both of those pieces of information, do the math, and give you the answer so that it's thinking. So, and now he has something called Wolfram Language, which comes in all new, what are those computers called? Blackberries? Those little, you know, $15 computers, and that you can use to run your quadricopters, etc. So he's, you know, expanding his ideas, but there's a great quote from Wolfram that I love. He says, "I think when I find the code that generates our world, it'll be about six lines." In other words, he believes that our world is computationally generated. And it's about six lines of code that are doing it. So these totally new ways of thinking. I have a colleague, Carl Shue, who professor of architecture, who gives his students at the beginning of the semester three genes, DNA, three rule sets. By the end of the semester, the building has grown itself. So, you know, what kind of world are we looking forward to? We think of those images we see of thousands and thousands of workers in Chinese factories making smartphones. Well, there used to be dozens of scribes making books, you know, writing things hand by hand. But now we can print books, and we just churn them out. The machine just, you know, you put the information in, you give it the file, the publisher wants a PDF, you plug that in, and out come the books. Human beings not needed. And so what happens when we have maybe just a slab of plastic and we print all the circuitry onto it for the whole cell phone? And very different worlds. And this is actually coming about. There's a figure at MIT named Neil Gershenfeld, something else for you to look up. And he has something called the Center for Bits and Atoms and something he calls a fab lab. So he takes 3D printers and routers and other machines, And he has a setup about the size of an office desk. He can take that to Africa. You need a bicycle? It can make it. It used to be you had to make a bicycle-making factory to make bicycles. Now you can just, I'll exaggerate, 3D print a bicycle. Skip the factory. And or if you need a part for a water pump, it can make the part for the water pump. And it can even make a cell phone. You say, well, now, wait a minute. I've got a chip in there that there's no way a 3D printer is going to make this chip with a billion transistors. True. But there's feedstock in the machine. In other words, there's plastics and metals and other materials, and you can even use local materials, scrap materials, that it puts together to make this. And one of the feedstocks is universal chips that can then be harnessed in various ways. So I want to wind up and apologize for not taking phone calls. I got carried away. But there's one more book I want to recommend. Maybe there's a couple more. But anyway, I want to recommend Virginia Postol's The Future and Its Enemies. Virginia Postol, P-O-S-T-R-E-L. We'll have her on the show in the future. And in her book, The Future and Its Enemies, she contrasts what she calls dynamism and stasism. So stasism is, or stasists are, people who want to control things. And so they'll say, yeah, the future is good as long as we control it. And dynamists are in favor of constant change, creativity, and exploration. And all of the things that drive us forward are never predicted, so that you see these periods of stagnation and then a new explosion. So in the 1980s, 1970s, things were dragging. In the 1980s, we got the personal computer. Nobody predicted that. It didn't do as much as we had thought, but then in the 1990s, we got networks and the internet, and we could link to our printer, and another explosion. And then in the 2000s, we got the commercial internet. So these things come in ways that we can't predict. And so in advocating for technological optimism, I'm advocating for an open-mindedness to an open world. So one more thought. Think about health. And remember we talked about the tricorder at the beginning of the show. It's a gizmo about the size of a smartphone. Your kid has a fever. You wave this thing over the kid. Now what? It communicates with IBM's Watson that does better diagnosis than any doctor. Your kid needs a certain drug. Well, you could email the drugstore and they could messenger it over, or you could just go to your 3D printer that can print out the drug that you need right there. So, new world emerging. This is John LaBelle. This is Visionaries, Progressive Radio Network. See you next Monday.